Here we are with Morris Berman. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're here in the wonderful Guanajuato, Mexico. How are you doing today?
Well, it's a very nice day in Guanajuato. It's a bit chilly, but here we are at the glorious Café Atrio. Very famous, and I think it's great that you and I can bask in the fame of the Café Atrio.
And so the purpose of this talk was to look at some of your past work, basically the trilogy of looking at the fall of the American Empire. Mm-hmm. How would you put it specifically?
Yeah, the decline of the American Empire.
And then later look at Mexico and what you see here, what you and I see here, and people, Americans like ourselves. My first question was, what really woke you up to what was going on in America? What was wrong with it? Where did it all start?
Well, I was writing that book in the 90s, and everybody was excited about Bill Clinton and that administration. We were prosperous. Isn't this great? We're all making money. You know, the truth is, not all of us were. The upper 1% were making a lot of money. And in the midst of all this hoopla about how great the U.S. was, what I was seeing was the slow erosion of the culture. You would see government-manufactured signs or corporate-manufactured signs with a misspelling of elementary words. You know, and I thought, my God, you know, this is... You didn't see this 10 years ago, you know? And just increasingly more violence and... A great stupidity on the part of the American public that, in the larger scheme of things, like Monica Lewinsky, you know, things like Monica or O.J. Simpson, that these were really trivial. They were sideshows. In a sense, that's true. But basically, the notion was that, you know, the United States is doing pretty well. I didn't think it was doing pretty well. And so, when I wrote that book, it was polemical, and it was really a kind of wake-up call in the sense that the spine of the book, central, hilo conductor, was that there were certain factors that led to the collapse of the Roman Empire, and there were four major ones that I identified. And that what I said was, these four are present in the United States today. And if we don't address them, we're going to go the same way. Of course, here we are 15 years after I wrote that book. What a shock, we didn't address them. Wow, what a surprise. And the United States is completely disintegrating. I mean, it's just coming apart at the seams. And although most Americans have their hands over their eyes and don't want to look at it, you know, 18% of the country is unemployed without any hope of getting a job. China has replaced us as the number one economic power. We have a national debt now that's through the roof, and the interest on it will soon, in a few years, be $1 trillion a year. The interest.
It'll go exponential.
Yeah. And there is no way of digging ourselves out of this. You know, I mean, there's no way of, historically, once an empire starts to collapse, it doesn't alter that trajectory. In fact, historically, what an empire does is precisely those things that accelerate the decline. And we are doing that. So, in certainly 20 years, we're going to have a very different country on our hands than we do right now. As just when I wrote the Twilight book. I mean, you know, Andrew Hacker had used in 1970, wrote a book called The End of the American Empire. It was kind of shocking at that time even to refer to the United States as an empire. Most Americans don't think of their country as an empire, but that's because most Americans are asleep in the snow. They're clueless. And their understanding of U.S. foreign policy is in the level of 7-year-olds. So the Hacker, in my mind, was one of the first that said we're in serious trouble. And then there were others, and so I was just in the line of those people that first of all said, this is an empire. I mean, we're not bringing democracy and goodness to the world. We're expanding our power. That's our goal. And secondly, we don't have a future in any real sense of the word. So that's what that book was about, you know. And for various reasons, the book caught on. It was named a notable book by the New York Times Book Review. It was, you know, a lot of people wanted to consider these things. And so it was a kind of surprise to me, but it was very successful. After 9/11, it became impossible to do those types of critiques. Fundamental critiques of the country were not welcome. And so the sequel to that, which was called Dark Ages America, was vilified by the New York Times in what was a dishonest hatchet job. And when I wrote into the New York Times as a response, they wouldn't print that letter. That's how cowardly they are.
It's the New York Times. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
What you expect?
That's right. Well, I you know, the whole notion of on the upper left-hand side, it says all the news that's fit to print. What I discovered was that the real motto is all the news that fits our views. That's the real motto, you know. And to get real news now in the United States, you have to go to things like Alternet, Truth Out, Common Dreams.
So talking about Dark Ages, you must have been in a great minority back then. How would you describe the scene back then and compare it to after your third book? I guess there's more voices now, and it's pretty obvious, I think, what you were writing about back then. How would you describe the scene?
Well, it really is a question of who you think you're reaching, I suppose. Okay, so Twilight was named a notable book by the New York Times. That's great. I mean, most Americans don't read. I mean, this has been well established now. They certainly don't read serious books. And it's also the case that if they read anything, it's a screen rather than a book. And I can't imagine that the themes of the book were really popular, you know, at the time. I mean, as I said, I think it did all right. But certainly after 9/11, there was no room for any discussion. I mean, the real truth of 9/11 is that Susan Sontag stated it in a New Yorker article in a series of interviews, the issue after 9/11, that if you really want to find out about 9/11, you need to look at U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Instead, the American public, not being very bright, in my opinion, just wants to say, well, these people are evil or insane, which is, pretty much what the government said. You know, they're jealous of our freedoms, and so this is an irrational act, and came out of nowhere, and so on. Well, you know, if you go back to the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and what we in British did in the Middle East, we've been screwing those people over, the Islamic people, for a century now. And, you know, after a while, when you really interfere with other people's lives and you make them miserable, they get angry. And this is the kind of reasoning that even now you can't talk about in the United States if you want to have a conversation with anybody. It's practically treason to say that we're creating the shadows, we're creating the enemies, you know. So there isn't much of a real dialogue in the United States. My work is really confined to a very tiny niche, you know. In general, if you pose a counter-narrative to the dominant narrative, what's going to happen is you're going to get marginalized. Nobody's going to know you even exist. I'm off the radar screen in the United States in terms of serious conversation. I think of somebody like Noam Chomsky. What has he published? Something like 40 books on U.S. foreign policy. If he wanted to get any of those books published, the only place he could go to for a long time was South End Press in Boston, which, you know, consisted of two guys and a typewriter. That was, you know. So this is what you're faced with. If you pose a challenge to the dominant narrative, the truth is that nobody's interested.
And so even with 20 years of this degeneration and collapse, nothing's changed with the audience.
All that's happened is that things have gotten worse in terms of dialogue. I've noticed that even among professors and supposedly intelligent people, whether it's online or in public debates, they're now generally screaming at each other. It has polarized. It's like we've lost the art of dialogue. Everybody's got a position, their narrative. They don't want to hear a challenge to it. If you challenge, they get enraged. It's been a breakdown of conversation and analysis. And what could ensure the collapse of the country better than that? You know, if you really can't have an intelligent discussion of the most fundamental issues facing the country, you're finished. And that's my argument. We're finished.
And then talking a bit about the culture and the Dark Ages especially, I'm a Croatian American, and I remember you cited a Croatian immigrant in the U.S. And there was, I guess, in that chapter you discussed about the culture, and this is something that I ask Mexicans here as well, because you know half of Mexico has been to the States, and there's always varying answers, but there's a great deal that say they go there for a while, but they couldn't live there, and they would rather live in Mexico. And so, what is it about Mexico, perhaps, that serves as, in some senses, it's got something that the U.S. doesn't have, tradition, easygoing lifestyle. What is it that differentiates Mexico?
From the United States?
The American culture. That makes it, well, why you're here, let's say.
Well, I was here because I finally, you know, to continue what we were talking about before, I finally had nobody to talk to. You know, if you feel that you're a stranger in a strange land, which certainly by 2004 I really felt, and then by 2006 I moved down. But it was 2004 that I said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this. Having no one to talk to was not a whole lot of fun. I came here because this is a culture that still has traditional elements in it, and I wanted to live in that culture, even though I understood that it's been heavily Americanized. Californicated, I think, is the expression.
Yeah, yeah.
This has happened, certainly, to Mexico. When I first came to Guanajuato in 2006, there was something really quiet and relaxed about it. Now it's been zombified with cell phones. Half the people you run into are walking down the street, you know. And so the Californication, this destruction of the culture, certainly is proceeding with great speed. But yet there's still something very gracious about Mexico that doesn't exist in the United States. Life is not here is not all about money and competition. people say buen provecho in a restaurant to other people. In the United States, they couldn't care if those other people lived or died. There are lots of things like that that make a tremendous difference to me, in the sense that, you know, if you're in a restaurant somewhere, or a bus, and you sneeze, everybody says salute. They don't do that in the United States. They don't care if you fall off the bus. So it's sort of like community, friendship, things that make life worthwhile on a human scale still exist here. My sadness is that the Mexicans themselves don't realize it. They take it for granted. And what they're going to have to do is get to a point where their whole culture is destroyed, and then they're going to say, gee, we really lost something. That's too bad. That's too bad. But for now, anyway, it still exists.
And I'm wondering, though, if it continues this way with Mexico, if they import the American dream, will you write a book then in Spanish of, you know, Dark Ages Mexico?
You know, I recently gave a talk about my work at Gandhi in Mexico City.
Right.
It was a talk for the vendedores of Gandhi and other major bookstores in Mexico. And very smart audience. And one guy in the audience, after I gave my little presentation, there were questions and answers, and one guy said, well, how long have you been here? I said, 9 years. When are you going to write a book about Mexico? And I said, you know, I'm really embarrassed by this question. I'm ashamed of myself. I have no excuse. I've been here 9 years. And for some reason, I mean, I just wrote a book on Japan. It took me 4 years to write. I said, I guess what I'll have to do next year is move to Tokyo and then write a book about Mexico. You know, but I said, I really don't have, I owe Mexico, excuse me, or at least my Mexican friends an apology that I haven't written a book about Mexico yet, and I don't know why that hasn't happened.
And an interesting point you brought up earlier of, there was someone close to me who basically said, they sent me an article about Mexico, and I don't get into politics with them because they get crazy if they're an American. And once we started arguing, she basically said, what was it, that she just wants to live a nice life, you know, in other words, materialist, hedonistic, and doesn't care about other people. Doesn't want to get into all the politics and dissect all of this stuff, and just wants to live basically looking ahead in the clouds. Mm.
That would be most Americans, and that's the American dream. I don't know if you ever saw the Seinfeld series.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I love this line. It was at the finale, the very last thing, where they're arrested for not caring for somebody, the Good Samaritan law, which exists in France, but not here, actually. Not in the United States. Well, so they're arrested, you know. And when Jerry calls his lawyer, which is a guy named Jackie Childs, who's a double for Johnny Cochran. You know, talks like him, struts like him, and so on. And Jerry explains that they were arrested for not helping somebody. And Jackie Childs says to him, the actor's name is actually Phil Morris. Jackie Childs says to him, you don't have to help anybody. That's what this country's all about.
Yeah, exactly. It's in Why America Failed, the last part of your trilogy, you talk about the hustler mentality. That's exactly it.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Look, David Mamet, I mean, anybody who's anybody in terms of writing stuff that's cutting edge and sophisticated, somebody like the playwright David Mamet, what are all his plays about? That basically we're all hustlers and we don't give a damn about anybody else. That film from 1984, I think, through 83, Glenn Carey, Glenn Ross, it's all about screwing the other guy, getting a leg up on somebody else. Your success is their failure. That's what America cares about, and that's what it does.
and that was epitomized in The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't know if you've seen it.
I didn't see the movie, but you know,
that was pretty much it.
Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal also was about the similar thing. And it's if you look at a series, you know, some of these things on TV are so brilliant. I'm actually flabbergasted, and part of it is because the collapse of the United States is furnishing really great material for writers. I'm thinking of things like House of Cards, where people murder each other and think nothing of it. That's my experience of Washington, D.C. People basically are destroying other people for their own careers. And the House of Cards, The Americans, another one is The Good Wife, which is about law firms, and their entire lives are about stabbing each other in the back for personal gain. And that's America. That's what it is.
Do you ever see yourself going back to the, as I call it, USSA? And some of your latest lectures and talks that I found online, you talk about how your job basically and that of others is, you can't stop this thing, this colossus. It's pretty much your job is to archive, right?
Why America failed was not an appeal to the American people to do something different or to be a different type of people. That's a foregone conclusion now. It was a post-mortem. And the difference between myself, well, there are two major differences between myself and these left-wing progressives, who I think are kind of sad. You know, I feel like patting them on the head. You're so cute, you know. I mean, all of them, Amy Goodman and the whole list of them. You know, there are two major differences. One is that if you're a serious left-winger, which I'm not, or a socialist or a populist, you see a better future ahead. That's the Marxian vision, that there'll be a dictatorship of the proletariat, that there'll be equality and justice. There will be no equality and justice in the United States, and there's no, at least in the immediate future, there's no better day lying ahead. So I think that what these people are claiming is going to happen is quite laughable. The second thing that's different is that they see themselves as really making a change. I don't see myself as making a change. I'm making no change whatsoever. But I'm doing what they and myself are doing the same thing, although I know the difference and they don't. That is to say, we are compiling an archive of why America failed. They are changing nothing but the data that they are assembling, these articles on common dreams and so on. That's good, useful information. And if somebody, you know, years from now, wants to research why America fell apart, the data will be there. But again, the difference is that their hopes and their self-image is very different from mine.
And another thing that I totally agree with you. I don't think that anything can be changed, and I think it's just all going to collapse. And I guess part of the reason that I talk to people about it as well is I'm just kind of in awe, you know. It's just kind of like you're like a little kid, and you see this big structure, and you're just kind of amazed, you know, about everything that's going on.
But that's the historical process,
yeah.
And that's what I mean. Civilizations rise and fall. This is the historical record. The United States is stupid enough to believe in American exceptionalism. We're going to beat the rap. Let me assure you, we are not. And we are not going to escape the fate that escaped other civilizations. That is not going to happen. And so, from one point of view, I think one has to just be philosophical about it. And really say, this is our time. This is our time. Certainly, it's not a good time to be a young person in the United States. You missed the boat. The time that was good to be a young person in the United States was when I was born, at the end of World War II, because we were opening up in a certain way, and those are the golden years. But this is the end of the curve. And when young people ask me about you know, what I can do to change the United States. They want to know, and so on. I said, the best thing you can do is leave. Because what do you think awaits you in 40 years? You think this situation is going to be turned around? Think again.
I have relatives who came from Yugoslavia in the 70s with no English. They began as janitors, and they became millionaires. And tried doing that today.
Yeah, right. Right. And besides that, even if they did it today, the real historical record, economic, statistical record is that there are very few self-made men. Most wealth is inherited in the United States. And it's kind of a joke, you know, when somebody like Oprah Winfrey says, you can change your own life through your mind. And if you need to network, join LinkedIn, something like this. The fact is that the people who have money, their uncle was a CEO of a major corporation. That's LinkedIn, in my opinion. LinkedIn is baloney.
It's the new old boys network. And we have the studies, right? What is it? They say the Walmart family owns 40% of wealth, and you've got this Swiss study that said, you know, what was it, 100 companies own half of the wealth in
sure.
the world.
But, you know, I have to point out to you, I think it was in colonial America. I don't have the reference in the exact data, but I remember reading this when I was researching why America failed. Something like in 1750, 4% of New York City owned more than half of the wealth in New York City. That's going back 250 years. This is the real pattern here. And the rest is just a smokescreen to get people to believe in the American dream, that if you work hard, you'll get ahead. That, you know, George Carlin once said, they call it the American dream because you got to be asleep to believe it.
All right, so where else, what else can you say about the trilogy, the degeneration of America? A lot of people ask, you know, how long is it going to take? Who knows? I always tell my students, you know, grab some popcorn and enjoy the show. it's not that I want it to happen, but it's just like you say, it's what can you do? You can laugh or you can cry. I might as well, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, walking around New York these days is like walking around Rome in AD 300. You know, I mean, it's a very similar thing. And you might as well enjoy the show. I think the best thing what any individual person can do is emigrate. And if not, what I talked about in the Twilight book was internal emigration. The new monastic individual who basically just withdraws from the society. Although, you know, a lot of the people I mentioned as examples have tried to preserve the culture and what's good in the culture, and that's an important thing. I don't have any other suggestions because a fomenting revolution is, in my mind, kind of stupid. You know.
And we've seen all of the successful revolutions in the past. Well, a lot of them, nonviolence is one of the best ways to go. You have Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and so. And I would recommend for people to leave the U.S. like we have. I mean, if it's up their alley, and, you know, I like the U.S. I visit every year. Not the place for me to live, but it's such a big world out there, and there's so many opportunities as well.
And the United States is merely 4.5% of the world population. I mean, you know, the stats are that with the exception of the occasional holidays in Mexico and Canada, Americans don't travel. 88% never leave the country, which accounts a lot for our U.S. foreign policy. 88% are totally clueless as to what's outside our borders. But, you know, it's such a narrow way of life that's just organized around consumerism and expanding your bank account and only knowing English. One language is what most Americans have, frankly all. It's just such a narrow, dumb way of life, really. And, you know, I can't imagine wanting to pursue it, you know. But most Americans are not very bright, and they will pursue that, you know.
At one point that you brought up, I thought was interesting, China. I don't know if you've noticed that here in Mexico, you know, when America was at its peak, we'd see Americans everywhere in foreign countries. And now we see a whole bunch of Chinese here in Mexico. I don't know if you've noticed the number of them speaking Spanish. But I don't know if you've noticed that. Or
well, Spanish is very popular in Japan. You know, I mean, young people. I mean, I was over there, and much to my surprise, people did not speak English. This even at a travel agency I went to, you know. And happily, I have a basic Japanese, a kind of ground level, you know, elementary Japanese, so I could navigate the territory. But if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been able to go to the bathroom, catch the right train. You know, I mean, I don't know how I would have done it.
That's,
you know,
surprising.
Yeah, yeah.
And then speaking of Japan, let's go to your latest work that came out in February.
February, yeah.
Neurotic Beauty?
Neurotic Beauty, yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't know where to begin. It's a very long book. It covers a lot of different aspects of Japanese culture. For me, it was very exciting. I was there twice doing the research. And it was exciting because Japanese culture is so different from Occidental culture that all your categories are turned upside down. It was so, you know, just a single example, just one. I have also always agreed with Marshall McLuhan that technology changes a culture radically. That technology is not neutral. And once introduced, it introduces the values of the dominant culture. You can see that with the way it's destroying Mexico with cell phones everywhere. Well, McLuhan would have had a hard time explaining Japan. Yes, everybody has a phone, a smartphone, but they don't talk on it in public. When I rode the metro in Tokyo, there was a sign in each car over the doors showing a cell phone, and then in English, the word off over it. Basically, group psychology of the Japanese means that above all, you have to consider society and community and not just yourself. It is dominated by the notion of consensus. It is not dominated by the notion of Clint Eastwood and every man for himself. And so here was a situation in which technology had penetrated the culture, and yet the norms of the culture had controlled the technology. Whereas, given the cowboy mentality in the United States, the cell phone has just made it easier for people who are already obnoxious to be more obnoxious. 100% of the American public is narcissistic. That's the American dream. You know, stir a cell phone into that, they just become more narcissistic. That's all.
And how would you fit in some of the extreme things that Japan is doing with technology? Like, you know, we've heard of the first marriage between robot and that sort of stuff.
Right, right.
On the other hand, they kind of go in that direction.
Yeah, the Japanese love new things. They're very much into that. And the number one major among undergraduates in Japan is engineering. But if they were strictly interested in making money, for example, the number one major, as it is in the United States, would be business. It's not. So why the interest in technology? It is partly that they are fascinated by newness. But the other part of it is that it's very continuous with the Japanese craft tradition. which is very powerful in Japanese history. And this is more craft.
And you wrote, I think it was in your latest interview with Salon, yeah, where you talked about the sword, the samurai sword maker, was that it?
Process of making a sword in Japanese history is a spiritual exercise, you know. So, I mean, all of this is very strong in Japan, and yet all that technology exists within a matrix of it has to be part of the community.
And so where do we go now between America, Mexico, Japan? America's on its way out, Mexico's emulating America, Japan is maintaining its tradition amongst these great changes in technology and the threat of against their tradition. So
well, it's a good question. I mean, one thing I have hopes for Mexico is that it would stretch back to its craft and native traditions, but if that does exist, it's just isolated pockets like Chiapas and Oaxaca. It's the majority of Mexico wants to be like the United States, which I think is a terrible, terrible thing and a sad thing for me watching it. America has no future, and it really is looking dark. 20 years from now, I imagine martial law imposed throughout the land, real chaos. Those riots that occur at Walmart every time a new tennis shoe is introduced, they'll be going on every day, but over food and water. It's a pretty bleak future for the U.S. Japan, on the other hand, this was just a speculation at the end of the book. It wasn't really a prediction, but other political thinkers have said the same thing as myself, that Japan may offer a model of a post-capitalist society. It may be the first to go post-industrial, and that's because it's increasingly dysfunctional. It has an aging population. It has a political party that's driven by neoliberalism and gave us Fukushima. And it may be the first to hit the wall. Capitalism will not last forever. Nothing does. And Japan may be the cutting edge of the collapse.
Well, and it's been a long, long time coming for them.
Yeah.
Well.
But in their case, you see, they have something to fall back on. The United States doesn't. Japan has a tradition of hundreds of years of a recycling culture, self-sustaining culture, a craft culture. We don't have anything like that. The United States was born bourgeois.
Or like the Chinese, who, centuries ago, their empire was number one, and now they're falling back to that again, because they're replacing the U.S., possibly, or at least right. they're rising, and they have that tradition that goes back.
Yeah, there is a whole, Confucian tradition. The only philosophical tradition that had any viability in the United States was pragmatism, as you would expect. Who was the American philosopher that, was it John Dewey, that talked about the cash value of things? Only in the United States would a philosophy be organized around the cash value of things,
It's one of the first things when you meet an American that they ask, right? What's your job? How much you make?
Yeah.
And all right, so any final closing thoughts?
Well,
on life?
To Mexicans,
yeah,
who are listening to this, do not emulate the United States. This is a very big mistake. To Americans who are listening to this, hit the road as soon as you can. And to the Japanese, please invite me over. I'd like to see you again.